Chapter 3. Into the Cold. Frank Rowlett wore civilian clothes as he made his way to an isolated lakeside summer cabin about 90 miles from the Canadian capital of Ottawa. It was autumn 1945, and the American codebreaker was going to meet a Russian spy. Rowlett was not there to betray his country, but to talk to a member of Russian military intelligence who had made that choice. It was a defection that helped instigate the spy fever that gripped America and Britain, and that would be a defining feature of the Cold War. Igor Guzienko was under armed guard in the cabin. He worked in the Soviet embassy in Canada and had only just escaped the clutches of the KGB, who had been searching for him. What no one knew at the time was that the KGB had been hot on his tail because they had been tipped off about his intention to defect by their master spy in London, Kim Philby. Guzienko's inside knowledge would help, in time, expose Philby's Cambridge spy ring and others offering secrets to Stalin. This was in part thanks to the first use of computer technology to catch spies. Guzienko revealed that the Soviet Union was running an espionage campaign against the West on a scale no one had grasped. Treachery, motivated by money or sympathy for communism, had reached deep into America and Britain, even into the most secret parts of the state, like the Manhattan Project building the atomic bomb. Guzienko was particularly valuable because he was one of those important people in Cold War espionage, a code clerk, in his case for Russian military intelligence, the GRU. That meant his job was to scramble the messages sent from a Soviet embassy back to Moscow so that they could not be read if they were intercepted en route. During his time in the cabin with Frank Rowlett, Guzienko was able to explain precisely how Soviet spies enciphered their messages. This included the way in which they used their ultra-secure one-time pads to add a random letter to a message to scramble it. Back in Washington, a small team of codebreakers hungrily devoured those details as they sought a way into a stream of Soviet diplomatic traffic that the U.S. had been intercepting but not able to decipher. The first attempts to break into Soviet codes during the war were assigned to a team numbering just two. The pair, one a high school teacher, Jean Graybeal, worked in the corner of a room also occupied by the British liaison to Arlington Hall. He was not supposed to know what they were doing, which meant they had to communicate in whispers. By 1943, the team had grown and made a breakthrough using data analysis. They had run 10,000 messages through a punch card machine made by IBM. This was not a computer but a processor which looked for what were known as depths in messages when a key had been used twice. They were amazed to find that this appeared to have happened in the Soviet traffic, but they were not yet sure what that could do with this insight. In late 1945, Guzienko's explanation of how the one-time pad system worked gave them further clues, although no final answer. It took a brilliant analyst called Meredith Gardner to make the crucial breakthrough. As the Nazi war machine had pushed into the Soviet Union, the carefully controlled system to protect codes had reached breaking point. The Soviets made the mistake of accidentally duplicating about 35,000 pages of one-time pads. This meant a small proportion of the one-time pads in circulation had become two-time pads and were no longer truly random. Work out which two messages had used the same pads, and you might be able to read them. But that was a huge job, a job for a machine. A machine might be able to work through all the traffic that had been collected in the past to identify the messages that could then be broken by hand. This project was known as Venona. The stakes were high. The KGB traffic out of the U.S. would contain details about Americans and other Westerners, some perhaps in senior positions, spying for the Soviets. The names might be in code, agents being referred to as Stanley or Homer, But with careful detective work to correlate details with other information, the traitors might still be identified. Klaus Fuchs, a German-born scientist who worked on both America's and Britain's atom bomb projects, was one of those exposed. Venona revealed him passing on secrets to his handler that allowed the Soviet Union to build its own bomb. Keeping Venona secret was so important that it could not be revealed in court, so in the Fuchs case, an MI5 interrogator had to slowly tease a confession out of him. Venona's revelations helped fuel the McCarthy era of witch hunts in Washington, amid fears that the Soviets had reached deep into the establishment. Oliver Kirby at the NSA worked on the traffic and was shocked by the evidence he saw of Americans taking money from the Soviets, much of which has still never been made public. He would personally brief his boss about the discoveries. He'd say, "Don't you say a damn word about that, because if we ever become Big Brother, we'll lose every nickel of the funding that we might get. So you never talked about that stuff. But it's there." There were tantalizing glimpses of a mysterious British spy, Homer, operating out of the embassy in Washington. The investigation was being run jointly with the British. Unfortunately for the spy hunters, the MI6 station chief in Washington was Kim Philby. He was indoctrinated into the Venona secret, no one realizing he was Stanley in the messages, and he tipped off fellow Cambridge spies Donald MacLean, Homer, and Guy Burgess, Hicks, who fled to Moscow. That intensified the spy hysteria sweeping Britain and America. In Britain, Philby's defection heralded a dark period for British intelligence, as its spy hunters became lost in a wilderness of mirrors, seeing Soviet agents everywhere around them, a world captured in the fiction of John le Carré. Venona did not provide real-time decoding of Soviet messages, only the ability to work back painstakingly through messages that dated mainly from the war. But it was considered so valuable that this piecing together of historical fragments to identify spies continued in secret until 1980. The desperate desire to break the messages led to the construction of computers specifically to work on the problem. The reason why Venona was pursued with such intensity was because this tiny glint of light was almost all the code breakers had to hold on to. In the first years of the Cold War, Britain and America had made progress against current Soviet cipher systems, as well as the historic Venona traffic. But then, on a day in 1948 known as Black Friday, the world went dark. The Soviets changed systems. Nothing could be read. By 1949, the four major Soviet cipher systems that had been broken were no longer being used. It was what Bletchley had always feared with Enigma. The new machines that appeared were much better protected. The cause was almost certainly betrayal. An American called William Weisband, who had worked in signals intelligence during the war, was spying for the Soviets and is believed to have passed on details until he was spotted, codenamed Zvenno, through Venona. There would be other betrayals like this during the Cold War, but few were so devastating. The costs were soon clear. Intelligence failures followed the blackout, the lack of any warning for the Soviet testing of an atomic bomb, the Berlin crisis, the smothering of Eastern Europe by communist regimes, the triumph of the communists in China and the Korean War. The golden age of reading your opponent's tactical and strategic messages with Nazi Germany and then, all too briefly, the Soviet Union, was over. There was a view in some quarters that signals intelligence was also over, a view much like the one heard when Germany had introduced its new naval Enigma machine a decade earlier. But rather than give up, a huge investment was made over decades to try to recapture that wartime success. The answer to the Russian problem, thought men like Howard Campaign in the late 1940s, had to be computers. Could they break the Soviet messages as Colossus had with the Germans? The secret world would invest heavily to find out. In the late 1930s, there had been those in America who were hoping to build something like Colossus, but institutional inertia and bureaucratic battles slowed them down. Instead, they focused in the war on the pressing task of building bombs and other machines to help with Enigma. After the war, America began to forge ahead. The secrecy that surrounded Colossus meant that the first machine to emerge in America after the war would claim its crown as the first computer. Cryptanalysis was the highly secret thread to the origins of computing, but at the same time there were other more public efforts allied to the military cause. Those included work on radar and firing artillery. The challenging job of calculating or computing how to fire an artillery gun so that it would hit a distant, perhaps moving, target, while also taking account of speed, bearing and wind, and doing so in a time that was practicable, had long involved machines. From the First World War, analog machines were being developed to help with this, and by the Second World War, electronics were being used. At the University of Pennsylvania, ENIAC was unveiled in 1946 to carry out ballistics calculations. It did not yet employ binary and had no memory to store its programs, but with Colossus a secret, it claimed the public title of the first computer and set off a race to build a more advanced model. In the secret code-breaking world, there were two paths and two different camps. One side favored building what were known as special-purpose cryptanalytic machines that did one thing but did it fast. In code-breaking, these were initially wired like bombs to work very quickly on a very specific attack against a specific cipher machine such as the Hajalin, similar to Enigma. Early special-purpose machines were codenamed Alcatraz, O'Malley, Warlot, Hecate, and Sled. But then, Howard Campaign and a colleague attended a hugely influential public conference at the University of Pennsylvania. They returned to the secret world to make the case for universal or general-purpose machines. These, as Turing had imagined, were flexible because they could be programmed with instructions. This became known as the von Neumann model after John von Neumann of Princeton and Pennsylvania, a leading mathematician and thinker on computing. A special-purpose computer worked on one type of calculation. The problem was that if your opponents changed their system, then your machine might become irrelevant. A general-purpose machine promised flexibility, even if it might be slower. Today, the NSA and GCHQ deploy both types of machines in their computer halls. The rapid advances made under pressure of war had meant that a long-dreamt-of vision was in reach, a universal or Turing machine, a high-speed electronic computer that could be programmed to undertake any mathematical or logical process. What was also needed was a way of storing instructions in a memory so that a computer could work through various options and become more than just a giant calculator. The technically challenging notion of giving a computer a memory would move beyond Turing's abstract concept of feeding in instructions on tape, and also the laborious task with Colossus and its early successors of having to wire up the machine physically. In post-war Britain, struggling with austerity and rationing, the influence of the Pennsylvania work led a handful of teams to begin work on a general-purpose machine. Turing himself had an unhappy experience at the National Physical Laboratory, NPL, in Teddington, where his desire to do everything from first principles clashed with more practically minded engineers. Other centres at Cambridge and Manchester, under Max Newman, who had brought Turing to Bletchley, made more progress with help from the people who had worked on radar during the war at the Malvern Research Centre. There was ample transatlantic cross-fertilisation of ideas, but Britain's progress initially seemed strong with the Manchester Baby and EDSAC, Electronic Delay Storage Automatic Calculator, the first stored program computers. GCHQ was determined to build the successors to Colossus, but in secret. 6 lectures were given to staff between July and November 1948 that gave an overview of what computers could do and developments underway in the UK and US. A few details of the organization's early computers have been released into the National Archives. Images of a machine called Kolarov reveal a vast steel structure with a veritable spaghetti of wiring spilling out of the back, which had to be replugged for every different function. Being a computer programmer in those days was essentially being an engineer. Much about these early machines remains classified, though. In Britain, the desperate need to break Venona and learn the identity of Soviet spies seems to have been a driving force in secret computer development. In 1954, GCHQ took delivery of a special-purpose machine codenamed Oedipus. Like Colossus, it worked on statistical probabilities. It looked for the likelihood of a message having been encoded with a particular one-time pad and codebook, processing 10,000 attempts in 1.6 seconds. There were hundreds of thousands of Russian diplomatic messages that had been collected, each of which had to be analyzed to see if there might be a match. By 1957, Oedipus appears to have had some success against Venona. The work against Venona was undertaken in a large wooden hut which sat off one of the main avenues at the Cheltenham site. A young analyst supervised the work, described as a joyous menagerie by one visitor, from a small office at the front. Behind him were teams of linguists working under harsh lamps, toiling for matches, looking at row after row of apparently random numbers to try to tease out clues which would then be sent on to MI5 and MI6. The effort against Venona remained a priority. The first computers were of little help, but by the early 1960s, new computers would offer the chance to look for matches at a much faster rate once the messages had been transferred onto punch cards in order to ease the burden on the teams beavering away. That job was farmed out to the Atomic Weapons Establishment's computers to begin with. At first, there were high hopes. The first message to be decrypted in 1963 by the new computerized system related to an agent codenamed Stanley, Kim Philby. A reference to Mexico, which Philby had worked on during the Second World War, might have provided a useful piece of evidence of his betrayal if it had been extracted earlier. But it was too late. Just months earlier, on a rainy January night, Kim Philby had fled Beirut on a Russian freighter. His arrival in Moscow was a shattering blow for British intelligence, and after that early promise, the intelligence take from Venona in Britain proved to be slim pickings, even as the workers toiled in their huts in Cheltenham. When the GCHQ codebreaker Hugh Alexander visited the US in October 1961, he could only wonder at the power of the machines the Americans were developing. He understood they might be strong enough to find the non-random patterns hidden in even the most advanced Russian cipher machines that British intelligence was having to find other ways of cracking, for instance by breaking into Russian embassies. A few years earlier, Britain's Joint Intelligence Committee, a place where Latin and Greek pentameters and cricket were the stuff of conversation, found themselves discussing their American cousins' enthusiasm for the use of computers in processing and recording intelligence, and whether Britain too should follow suit. The idea was kicked into touch. Britain, and especially its establishment, were still largely old-fashioned in its ways, with its bowler hats and briefcases. Computers might be vital for code-breaking in Britain, but they were niche. Even with GCHQ, most of the intelligence team remained paper-based until well into the 1980s, with senior intelligence officials having no need or clue how to actually operate a computer. GCHQ officials who visited their American cousins often came away in awe of the use of computers to do things like track missile launches in real time, an aspect of signals intelligence which was not about communications. Meanwhile, American codebreakers who visited their British colleagues were struck by two things: the role of trade unions and the concept of public footpaths, which meant ramblers tried to wander through sensitive sites. Post-war austerity Britain was broke. Spies in MI5 and MI6 were much more comfortable with pen and paper than these expensive computer gadgets. America, less rooted in the old ways, with a stronger faith in technology and closer ties to companies, drove ahead. The different approach was most evident in the relationship between spies and the private sector. The reports from Pennsylvania led the Navy to build a machine called Atlas. 20 feet long, it was named after a comic strip character who was a mental giant. It was constructed primarily by Engineering Research Associated, ERA, a captive company linked to the Navy, who delivered a version at the end of 1950 for $1 million, triple the original cost. ERA was then, with Navy permission, able to spin off a version for sale to the wider world. Already, individuals were moving back and forth between industry and the secret state in America in a way they did not in Britain. What did they use the new computer for? It is telling that the very first operational program written for Atlas was designed to attack anomalies in Venona messages, another little-known sign of just how important this task was in advancing computing. The old rivalries were still there, though, and the Army had worked on their own system. This was called Abner, after yet another comic strip character, a powerfully built country bumpkin. These machines spent as much time not working as working, but when they did perform, the results were astounding, and everyone could see the potential, perhaps explaining why they were given the names of comic book superheroes. In England, commercial computing was initially motivated by providing a nice cup of tea. The Lyons Catering Company led the way in building a machine that could be sold. It may seem an odd fit, but with all its tea shops around the country, Lyons was at the leading edge of management techniques and data processing, looking for ways to become more efficient in supplying its shops with what they needed, when they needed it, and as automatically as possible. The company worked with Morris Wilkes, who had explored electronic radar at Malvern, to develop Leo, which was used from 1953 to replenish tea shops each morning and do the payroll, more national insurance than national security. 100 Leo computers would be sold abroad, but the Lyons computer team eventually merged unhappily with English Electric. British governments tried to create a national champion in English Electric, and then ICL, but each merger meant effort was expended trying to blend incompatible computer systems and management teams rather than innovation. The story of the British computer industry after the war was one of brilliant engineering, but business failure. Those early British computer companies would become roadkill, crushed under the juggernaut of the American giant IBM once it moved into computing. British declassified files show how in 1960 Britain's atomic weapons establishment was desperate for a new computer for warhead design and was being offered a rental deal by IBM. In Whitehall, top officials all agreed that IBM was using its contracts to eliminate British competition, but they felt cornered. IBM built fast and offered compatibility and upgrades. In 1955, there were 30 computers running in the UK, and all were British, but by the end of the 1960s, IBM was dominant. America's success emerged from a unique relationship between spies and companies that neither side liked to talk about. It is ironic that the free market US ploughed massive amounts of NSA and Pentagon money into the private sector, providing a state subsidy that socialist Britain, with its nationalized industries in other fields, never matched. The US also had a larger domestic market, which helped. The NSA was so desperate for a breakthrough in the early Cold War that it paid millions to companies for computers which almost never lived up to the promises and which went wildly over budget. All the major U.S. computer companies would open up their own special security-cleared departments solely to work with the intelligence agencies. In the shadow of what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, a spy-industrial complex was emerging involving the computer industry, centered partly around Washington, D.C., but also Northern California, where a raft of high-tech companies were springing up close to Stanford University in a region which would become known as Silicon Valley. IBM grew to be dominant as it realized that government contracts could subsidize its research, which would then spin off into commercial work. There were those in the NSA who felt IBM was too close and was taking the agency for a ride. The most ambitious project was Harvest, in which special-purpose machines were controlled by a general programmable computer. It aimed to be 100 times faster than anything else. After the NSA originally signed up IBM to build Harvest, it was told it would cost nearly double the amount planned, take longer, and not be able to do quite everything that was originally agreed. The NSA also realized that the near $10 million bill did not include the software or programming, eventually costing another $4 million. As usual, the agency has a firm hold on the IBM leash and is being dragged down the street, an engineer wrote. Harvest was delivered in February 1962 and ended up being used for 14 years on cryptanalytic projects. Working on Harvest involved sitting in a busy operational area with a series of desks, terminals, printers, and tall storage cabinets. The 1950s were years of growth and optimism in America, of cars, consumerism, and suburbs. And behind all of this was technology. In secret, the desperate desire to break stubborn Soviet codes was driving computer development harder and faster. The $25 million project Lightning was authorized by President Eisenhower in the 1950s. A jet plane can go 100 times as fast as a man can run. A computer can go 10,000 times as fast as a man can compute. Lightning will go 10 million times as fast, Howard Campaign wrote. Working with a range of contractors, the project helped develop techniques like high-speed circuitry that then bled out into the commercial world. One company in California said it could develop a tube that could switch in 3 nanoseconds. No one could even measure that to know if it was true. Campaign argued that the NSA played a crucial but hidden role in leading the way in fields like solid-state transistors and even voice recognition. By the end of the 1950s, there were 24 special-purpose computers that could digitize an audio message and scan the text for keywords. If a keyword was not present, it could be discarded, thus reducing the burden on human operators. And yet, for all this technology, the 1950s remained barren years in the core task of reading Soviet messages, with talk of giving up. In early 1957, a possible break called Hairline led to some excitement for the few in on the secret. $20 million was allocated and 6 new special-purpose machines were built to run through the nearly 638 quadrillion, 73 trillion, 495 billion, 557 trillion, 89,200 mathematical possibilities. But by the early 1960s, it was only opening up a small percentage of traffic which carried low-level information. An official review suggested the age of heroic cryptanalysis had ended. The future, many thought, lay in the CIA's new toy, the U-2 spy plane, which could carry out aerial reconnaissance. The CIA was also pushing its own cryptanalytic team. At the CIA, the spies engaged in recruiting and running agents were learning about the potential of computers to store and retrieve data as the 60s began. Just after Alan Dulles stepped down as director of the CIA, he spoke of his wonder at what the machines were capable of. "The intelligence service needs a man who speaks Swahili and French, has a degree in chemical engineering, is unmarried and over 35, but under 5'8". You push a button and in less than 40 seconds a machine, like those commonly used in personnel work, tells whether such a man is available, and if so, everything else there is on record about him. What, before the advent of the machine, might have taken the analyst weeks of search and study among the files, the machines can now accomplish in a matter of minutes." Declassified files from the time reveal that the agency, though, also had concerns about this. Considerable thought went into ensuring that highly sensitive information about the identities of its undercover agents was kept compartmented on computers so that even others inside the CIA could not access it. And already there were fears of being overwhelmed by the multitude of tiny fragments of intelligence flowing into the CIA from all its different sources. There were already too many snippets for people to be able to catalogue by hand. And without a working index, we become a large but unusable library, one 1966 report warned. It was no good just holding information. You had to know you had it. The study argued that what was needed were powerful electronic arms, which will continually reach out and gather in relevant information, arrange and correlate it, and present it to us. It is also likely that we can look towards machines which are self-improving. 3 decades before Google and its algorithms came along, here was the idea of a search engine. The real secret of American and British code-breaking in the Cold War is that they did not really succeed in breaking Soviet codes. Instead, they did something else with the help of computers. They had learnt from Bletchley the power of traffic analysis, studying the externals of a communication even when you could not break into its content. This required collecting and analysing every detail and intricacy of the system you were trying to break, how it was structured, how people used it, and what was produced, so that you could find that weakness or mistake which code breakers and their computers could work on. "You must know much more about the other man's signals than he knows himself," Oliver Kirby, an American veteran of Bletchley turned NSA man, told his successors. "You needed to understand the normal so that you could spot the abnormal, which might be a chink in the armor you could then target. But there was a further point. Even if you could not break the code, the data also had a value in itself if enough was collected and analyzed properly. A bit like tracking Zeppelins through call signs in the First World War, you could watch the outward behavior of Soviet military communications. That required a huge effort, and the data required to feed this beast in turn led to the creation of a vast global enterprise." By the early 1960s, over 100,000 Americans were involved in intelligence work, more than half in signals intelligence. Of those, half were at overseas sites, collecting signals in remote stations or on board clandestine ships or from airborne platforms. By 1955, there were more than 2,000 listening stations. These sent 37 tons of intercepted material to the NSA each month. Another 30 million words of teletype intercept were also arriving. The traffic analysis section was dealing with 3 billion message groups a year. They might be punching a million IBM cards a month for just one problem. There were also the 250,000 Chinese enciphered messages a year. This was a gargantuan task, one based around mammoth large-scale data processing and computers which could seek to tease out meaning from this torrent. The analysts in the UK and US studied in great depth the call signs used by each part of the Soviet military to communicate. Through this alone, they were able to establish the Soviet order of battle on the other side of the Iron Curtain, which units were where. This information would then be supplied to the land forces commanders on the ground so that they knew what they would be up against in the event of war. Every month, when new call signs were introduced by the Soviets, the GCHQ and NSA analysts would race each other to be first to get it done. In this game, the British always liked to make the most of the advantage the time difference gave to try to win. As well as tactical military help in the event of war, this system also offered the chance of early warning. At GCHQ, traffic analysis involved looking for tiny changes in the normal pattern of Soviet communications by watching behavior and the externals of messages, rather than the content, which was encrypted. The aim was to offer ministers 72 hours warning that Soviet forces were on the move and that the Third World War might be beginning. He or she would then go through it line by line with a pen looking for unusual patterns. This technique remained in use through the 1980s, with personal terminals only arriving that decade. The parameters of Cold War signals intelligence were soon set. Bletchley had shown Britain and America that code-breaking required a mix of people and machines. Computers did not replace people, quite the opposite. They often ended up needing more people to collect and then input all the data and then work on the output. Solomon Kulbach, who had started in the days of pen and paper with Friedman in 1930, was careful to avoid making computers appear as either the problem or the solution. "The computer never will replace the human element," he said, explaining that the machine was "a very stupid but very fast and accurate clerk who will do what you program it to do." And all these stories about computer error or that the computer fouled up ain't so. All the computer did was what it was told to do, and if whoever told it what to do fouled up the instruction, then the computer did too. No, the computer will never replace the human in terms of judgment. Machines were not enough by themselves, but allied to people they were proving immensely powerful, able to work on a vast scale. At the time, some called the era after the Second World War the Atomic Age, but in reality it was as much the Computer Age. Both were defining symbols of the end of that last conflict and the arrival of the Cold War. And computers were already breaking out of the confines of the secret state.